Labyrinths is brought to you by Knox Robinson Productions. Please consider becoming a patron. For as little as $5 a month, you can listen to Labyrinths ad-free.
Visit patreon.com/KnoxRobinson to learn more.
You know, the movies get a lot of credit for the ultimate release of the West Memphis 3, and I don't want to be falsely humble and act like the movies had nothing to do with it, but filmmakers making a film that shines a light on wrongful conviction is cool, but I don't think it's that special. I was being paid by HBO to make a film. That's my job. Celebrities coming in and helping, that's cool, but regular people, the tens of thousands of people who saw Paradise Lost and then found each other on the internet, decided to create a movement called the WM3.org. That, to me, to take your 2 weeks vacation in Arkansas to protest at an appeals hearing,
yeah,
that, to me, is what moved the needle, what ultimately got these guys out of prison.
Feeling lost?
Then you're in the right place.
I'm Amanda Knox.
And I'm Christopher Robinson.
And this is Labyrinths.
In our last episode, we talked to Jason Baldwin of the West Memphis 3. In 1993, Jason and two of his friends were falsely accused and charged with the killing of 3 8-year-old boys. They were convicted of the crime despite the fact that there was no physical evidence for their guilt. Jason and his friend Jesse Miskelly got life in prison, while their friend Damian Eccles got the death penalty.
The three of them spent almost 2 decades in prison. They were finally released on an Alford plea, a little-known plea deal that allows the state to release innocent people without admitting that the original conviction was an error. As a result, all three men are still formally convicted of murder and fighting for full exoneration.
In the 30 years that have passed since the murders in West Memphis, a community of supporters of the West Memphis 3 has grown. Their advocacy was a big reason that the case was reconsidered at all. Even celebrities like Johnny Depp and Natalie Maines lent their voices to the cause.
The public attention on the case is the direct result of a series of documentaries about the West Memphis 3 called Paradise Lost. The first movie was filmed during the first trial and ends with Jason and Damian's conviction. The second and third films continue following the case and finish with their release from prison.
In a statement given to the police and obtained by a Memphis newspaper, 17-year-old Jesse Miskelly allegedly confesses to watching two other suspects choke, rape, and sexually mutilate 3 West Memphis second graders.
The murders had been part of a satanic ritual.
Satanic worship.
A horrific ritualistic sacrifice.
We're just sitting on the couch watching TV the night we were arrested.
They had to find somebody to pin this on. This publicity was getting out of hand.
It's hard to overstate how important the films were for securing the eventual release of the West Memphis 3. Without them, Jason and Jesse could still be languishing in a prison cell in Arkansas, forgotten by the world and condemned by their own community. Damian would probably be dead.
The films were directed by Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sanofsky, two young, up-and-coming filmmakers who were fresh off of the success of their first movie, Brother's Keeper. Bruce passed away in 2015, but Joe is still making movies. We talked to him about what it was like filming the series that led to the release of The West Memphis 3.
We watched in quick succession all three parts, and we were like, wow, Joe spent 20 years doing this story, and he grew up as a filmmaker in this. And I mean, obviously you were doing films before this, but...
Well, that's accurate. Brother's Keeper, the first film that Bruce Sanofsky and I made, was, you know, I did not have the social justice gene in me. Brother's Keeper was made at a time when documentaries were not nearly as popular as they are now, and a theatrical documentary was almost unheard of. Brother's Keeper was all about the aesthetics of filmmaking and pushing the envelope on what is a documentary and expanding the definition of what could be a documentary. But it was Paradise Lost that turned me into a social justice filmmaker. And the irony of that is when we started making Paradise Lost, we thought we were making a film about kids killing kids. That's what the press was reporting. Sheila Nevins at HBO sent us an article about these three teenagers in West Memphis, Arkansas, who were accused and had just been arrested for these devil-worshipping murders. So we went down to West Memphis, Arkansas, and I wouldn't say that I was enveloped by satanic panic, but certainly things like the McMartin case were in the rearview mirror. The Jamie Bulger case, which was a two-year-old in the UK, murdered by two 10-year-olds, was in our rearview mirror just in February of 93. So there seemed to be this social thing going on where kids were killing kids and there was concern about satanic cults. And we just fed right into it. We sent an article about these satanic ritual murders. And that's what we thought we were making a film about. How could three teenagers be so rotten and disaffected with life that they could do such a terrible thing as to sacrifice 3 8-year-olds to the devil? That's what I thought we were making a film about. You see in the movie, Chief Inspector Gary Gitchell says on a scale of 1 to 10, the evidence is an 11. There was a confession printed in the newspaper, which was just incredible. That could actually happen and pollute the jury. But what nobody knew was it was a false confession. We later learned that it was multiple statements given over multiple time periods. No one actually understood what false confessions were at that time. It was a relatively new phenomenon. And it took us months to get access to the West Memphis Three. We arrived a week after the arrest, so in June of 93, and mainly spent time with the families of the victims who wholeheartedly believed that three devil-worshipping teens had sacrificed their kids to the devil in a satanic ritual. And I had no reason not to believe them. The police, I was naive. I was 28 years old. That's not to say I was gripped by satanic panic and thought that they were literally devil worshipers, but it seemed like they were guilty. The media. Yeah,
you didn't write it off as a crazy possibility.
Yeah, that these guys were kind of deluded and doing some kind of I had no reason not to believe it because at that time I believed the police and I didn't have the nose that I have now for injustice and all the problems in the criminal justice system. It took us till about November to negotiate our first interviews with these guys, and I remember these interviews like it was yesterday, because in particular interviewing Jason Baldwin is what made me realize something is not right here. I mean, you see the interview in the film. He's a slight, tiny kid, sweet, shy kid who took school seriously and got good grades, but had the misfortune of being best friends with the quote-unquote local misfit, Damien Eccles. And Damien was harder to read because I think Damien was kind of, at that time, enjoying the attention a little bit. I think he didn't never believe it could turn out the way it did, so he kind of like was poking people and giving them spooky looks and, you know, kind of enjoying it because he was a teen with a chip on his shoulder and couldn't believe this was happening.
Right.
So he was harder to read. Jesse Miskelly also was harder to read because he has a low IQ. You know, I don't think I'm being insulting if I say, you know, he is not the brightest person. And so he was harder to read as to his guilt or innocence. But like while I'm interviewing Jason Baldwin, something struck me. And this is after months and months of spending time with families of the victims who were utterly convinced that these kids were just rotten murderers and the police telling us that the case is so strong. But I remember literally looking at Jason Baldwin's wrist, his tiny little wrist, because he's gesticulating when he's talking to me. And I'm trying to imagine that hand wielding a 10-inch serrated hunting knife, castrating Christopher Byers, one of the 8-year-old victims, and all these other assorted wounds, which, interestingly, at the time, we all thought those were knife wounds. As it turns out, a lot of those wounds were post-mortem animal predation, but the prosecution story was knife wounds. And I remember looking at his wrists, talking to him, I was just overwhelmed with, something ain't right here. 1 + 1 is not equaling 2. And so Bruce Sanofsky and I had a chat on the way back to the hotel, and we were both like, we're troubled by this, to the point where I felt like I had to call Sheila Nevins, who is the head of documentaries at HBO. And Sheila's been incredible. She has varied tastes. She likes salacious material as much as she likes highbrow material. And she sent us down, I'm 28, 29 years old. It's my second film. It's HBO finally, the first film was made through credit cards and second mortgages on homes. This was the first film where, oh, HBO has called. And at the time, if you weren't selling your documentary to HBO or PBS, you weren't making a documentary. Those were the only games in town back then.
Right.
Hard to believe that documentaries have become so popular since then. But this is our big moment. HBO has called, and we're supposed to be making a film about satanic ritual murders. And I remember calling Sheila up with a lot of trepidation because I half expected her to say, okay, well, if it's not a kids killing kids satanic ritual film, pack your bags and come home. So I said, look, I think the wrong people have been arrested. I couldn't imagine that it would actually end up in a trial and that we'd witness the most horrendous modern day witch hunt that you could ever imagine, where no evidence, well, you can imagine, of course, Amanda, but you know, at the time I couldn't imagine we would ever, you know, witness a modern day witch hunt where there was literally no evidence to connect these guys to the crime. I mean, physical evidence, all the stuff we later learned. This is still November of 93. A trial date hasn't even been set. For all I knew, they were going to plead out. But I said to Sheila, I'm not sure they got the right people. And you should know that this does not feel like a satanic ritual killing. And she said, to her great credit, she said, well, stick with it. That sounds more interesting. And boy, did we stick with it. We ended up making three films over 20 years because the first film garnered a lot of support, but Arkansas didn't seem to be moved by it. So we start questioning. This is where I cut my teeth in my investigative skills and my realization that these kinds of things happen. And the final scene of Paradise Lost was actually one of the most emotionally devastating moments of our lives. And the access we got, I still marvel at where we were allowed to stick that camera. It's still amazing to me that we were able to document this. People are too media savvy today. Paradise Lost, I don't think, could have been made.
Yeah,
today.
No.
That final scene of Paradise Lost, where Damien Echols and Jason Baldwin are being chained up, and we're in the back room as we're being chained up and being led into squad cars. Jason is going off to, you know, for a life without parole sentence, and Damien is headed to death row. And we just couldn't believe what we had just witnessed. We were just totally devastated. And that's where my social justice and wrongful conviction focus kind of just was born. I couldn't believe what we had witnessed.
We could give you lots of reasons to support Labyrinths on Patreon, including ad-free episodes and exclusive patron-only content. But why not hear it direct from a listener?
My name is Henry, and I've been a supporter of the Labyrinths podcast for some time. I can totally relate to the concept of feeling lost, and I think the stories have helped me tremendously getting through these last couple of years, and I think they would help others as well.
Visit patreon.com/KnoxRobinson.
Looking back at it now, the conviction of the West Memphis Three seems nonsensical. How could the world have believed such a flimsy story? Were the presence of some black t-shirts and some niche religious interests really enough to convince people that these teenagers were the kind of people who could brutally murder three young boys? To make sense of how people could believe this, it's helpful to revisit what society was like back in 1993.
We're definitely seeing a rise of interest in evangelicalism, especially during the 70s and 80s, in direct response to things like the Manson family. And then suddenly we have this like Gen X punk metal response to that overly conservative religious influence. How do you feel like your film fits into this cultural movement and shift? And did you find that your audience tended to find itself on one side of this shift or another?
I think Paradise Lost struck a deep chord in people because they saw themselves, hey, I dressed in black when I was in high school. Hey, I was a a little alienated. I listened to heavy metal. I think so many people saw themselves in Damien. You know, I used to dress in black. I used to listen to Metallica. I was a bit of a outcast. I didn't get along with people in town. I didn't believe in religion. I mean, I just heard that over and over again. And so I think it kind of fits in there. I mean, it really came at an interesting time because I went into the project, you know, just hearing rumblings of the McMartin case. The McMartin case is a really important because the McMartin case was like the longest running trial, most expensive trial in U.S. history. Mm-hmm. And I think people had that in their brain in West Memphis, Arkansas.
The McMartin preschool case is one of the largest, earliest, and most explosive examples of the satanic panic. It began in 1983. When the mother of a child who attended the McMartin preschool in California accused a teacher at the school of raping her son. When questioned by social workers using leading interview techniques, hundreds of children who'd attended the school ended up recounting stories of abuse perpetrated by members of the staff. Some made fantastical claims that included satanic rituals and secret tunnels under the school. Only a handful of those children testified at the eventual trials. No one was ever convicted of a crime in the McMartin case, but the trials didn't end until 1990 and were covered heavily by the media, costing the state $15 million by the time it was all over. Despite the lack of convictions, the accusations and media spectacle around them firmly cemented the idea of satanic ritual abuse in the popular imagination.
And, you know, these things were kind of swirling around my head culturally, like, oh, yeah, there must be satanic cults. And because I was just, you know, a consumer of info. And then to be immersed in this case, which just proved the opposite of what the situation is and the danger of falling for that kind of conspiracy thinking, just was mind-boggling. But I saw evidence throughout everything we did. You see in the movie, we cut to signs in front of churches with their slogans right upon the arrests. Every Sunday, the local ministers were talking about Satan as a real entity that lives amongst us and that Damien was a devil worshiper. It was just an incredible example of that hysteria. The movie opens with some very graphic police crime scene footage. And at the time, that was rather new to go that far in showing horrifying footage, and was a very considered decision. It was very controversial at the time. A lot of people criticized us for showing that horrible footage of the 3 8-year-olds when they were found in that creek in Robin Hood Hills. But we felt it was so important to show that footage so that the audience could have an understanding of how scared and horrified people must have been so that they could fall victim to this kind of mass hysteria. Because the crime needed to have an answer and needed to have closure. People wanted to let their kids out to play again. And so we wanted to show people just what the community was facing so that you could understand how people could have this rush to judgment. The other thing is, I hope it's not being perceived as me knocking religion, but this was a very religious part of the world where people believed the police, where the idea of false confessions wasn't even on the radar, and where people literally believed that the devil walks amongst you. And so it was that crucible that allowed a case to be believed where there was literally no evidence.
Yeah.
No blood at the crime scene, no real forensic evidence, just, you know, Stephen King novels and Metallica lyrics. And, you know, yeah, he liked Anton LaVey, but does that make him a killer? I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, I find it an interesting way of looking at this whole saga of these films is that there's maybe you could say two cults. One of them is totally fictional. Never existed, as John Douglas says in the film. Of all the satanic panic cases, not one of them actually turned out to be satanic ritual murder. It like doesn't even really exist.
Yeah, the FBI went on record saying that, you know.
And, but then there is this other cult, the sort of cult of justice, that arises as a response to this thing. And the documentary and you are a part of that movement. The documentary itself becomes increasingly a subject of the documentary. You're covering the movement of people who care about justice and who care about truth.
Well, his movement is in direct response to a very real movement that arose to the perception of satanic panic, which is a bunch of fake experts who are going around the country saying, I know what's going on with these satanic cults, and a very actual conspiracy arose in response to this fake conspiracy, which is a bunch of legal and forensic experts, quote, who are saying the satanic panic is real. And then, of course, Joe is a part of the response of being like, wait a second, all y'all are claiming to be experts on a thing that doesn't exist.
Yeah, that hysteria of the satanic panic seems like it was necessary to create the culture of that formed around the film in support of the West Memphis 3, like a sort of only something so crazy could lead to this culture of justice and awareness of wrongful convictions. Were you surprised by the movement that arose around the film and by the awareness that grew among supporters about this injustice?
It totally blew me away, actually, and it's why the second film focuses on the activities of the WM3 support group, you know, Kathy Bakken, Grove Pashley, Burke Stalls. You know, interestingly, Paradise Lost was the last documentary that we shot on film, and film is a slower, more laborious process, and we edited on film. We literally cut on film, ripping tape splices apart, hanging pieces of 16-millimeter film on it. And I mean, it's a whole other era of filmmaking. That was digital was just happening, but we were still stuck in film. And so because of that, the film took actually longer to edit. And so the film didn't come out until 96. And I think that was incredibly fortuitous for the case, because right around 96 was when the internet was just starting to come into its own, what I call social media 1.0. Obviously, there was no social media, but at that time, the internet was just starting to be used with, you know, chat rooms and people finding each other of like-minded interest and self-created websites and all that kind of stuff literally was just happening in 95. So Paradise Lost and the fate of the West Memphis 3, I think, were very much inextricably linked to the burgeoning internet, because the explosion of interest in the film caused people to go to the internet and say, God, I got to find out more about this. And they found other people and a community formed, literally tens of thousands of people, to advocate for the West Memphis 3. And I think that's what made the difference. And then the other thing that's remarkable is the reason a website was there full of information that allowed people to find each other is that when HBO was about to start marketing the film, they needed a poster. And so they went to the poster company, and this woman named Kathy Bakken just got a VHS cassette, not even a finished copy of the movie, to wrap her head around the film, because she was working at a company that would design the posters. She saw the movie, totally blown away by it, called her friends, Burke Sahls and Grove Pashley. And these are the guys who started the Free the West Memphis 3 website. And they put every piece of information they could find. They did the work that nobody else did and dug stuff up and created this website that for years was the only source of information and was the place people went and found each other. So I am amazed at the response that the film had. You know, wherever the movie went, just people just couldn't believe it. You know, Sundance, at this point in my career, I've had 8 movies premiere at Sundance. I've made, I don't know, 18 maybe documentaries, hundreds of hours of TV. I've been to many screenings of my work. I've been to festivals all over the world. And no film has prompted more intense reaction and debate. Usually at a film festival, half the people stay for a Q&A because everyone has things to do. Even some people leave at the end of your movie. You're not supposed to be offended because they've got some other thing on their schedule. Nobody left. People would follow us out because they still wanted to talk. I mean, it prompted such an intense response.
Celebrities, too, were touched by the story.
I ended up having a lifelong friendship with Metallica over this movie. People think I was somehow connected to Metallica, but it's really because Metallica gave us the music for the film, because we felt it was so essential to have Metallica music in the film. And at that point, they had never given any of their music to any film. They didn't license their music. And I reached out to them and said, hey, heavy metal music is on trial as much as these kids. And they responded to that and couldn't have been nicer, and were the first celebrities to join. So Metallica lyrics were introduced into trial as evidence that these guys were you know, devil worshiping teens, which is absurd on so many levels. First of all, since when does your choice of music define you as a killer? But there is death metal that is more satanic in nature, but Metallica lyrics have nothing to do with devil worshiping or any of these issues. They're anti-authoritarian, which was the cultural movement, but they have nothing to do with devil worshiping. So my pitch to Metallica was, your lyrics are on trial as much as these kids. They responded to that pitch and gave us music for all three films and actually never charged us anything for it. That it was a gift. And they were the first guys in to really support the cause.
And the cause needed all the support it could get. Because for all the attention the case was getting around the country, none of it seemed to make a difference in the only place it really mattered, the state of Arkansas.
Paradise Lost moved everyone who watched it. It was horrifying to watch three teenagers have their lives destroyed by a deeply flawed justice system. And it was also fascinating to watch a documentary that was trying to be more than a boring made-for-TV movie.
In the evolution of documentaries, I think there were three kind of golden ages that really made the modern documentary explode to the popularity that it has ascended to now. The first revolution was in the early 60s. They invented portable sync sound filming, which didn't exist before, which sounds so basic. You know, today you point your phone or your camera and you get sync sound. You can film anything. But in the days of film, you could not go out into the real world with a film camera and a separate audio recorder and get sync sound. So documentaries until the early 60s were relegated to newsreel footage where they narrated it after the fact. And so that led to just reportage as documentary. But in the mid 60s or early 60s, Penny Baker, Maisels, Drew, these guys all came together and they invented what's called portable sync sound filming with this crystal sync technology. So you could go into the real world with a film camera and an audio recorder that weren't connected and weren't plugged into an electrical source. And you could come back with footage that was in sync. It sounds so basic, but that was a huge revolution. But it wasn't just a technical revolution. There was also an aesthetic revolution. That's when the idea that, gee, we can go out into the real world, follow characters, and create these ambiguous human portraits that are as dramatic as any scripted film. Everyone in this business owes what they do to that. The second revolution, I think, was in the late 80s, early 90s, with a group of filmmakers who were trying to expand what the definition of a documentary is. I will have to say I include myself in that group with Brothers Keeper. We were highly aware of a certain kind of shooting style, using a compelling opening title sequence, using a music score, which back then was kind of unheard of because you're not supposed to do things like music score or opening title sequence because that's not journalistic and it's manipulative. Obviously, every documentary today does what I'm talking about. And we weren't the only ones, but we were making very highly cinematic documentaries. And pushing the envelope. Errol Morris was pushing the envelope. He's obviously part of that group. Errol Morris was pushing the envelope of what a documentary could be by championing recreations. He really is the first documentarian to do these cinematic recreations, which has now become a staple. Michael Moore was redefining the definition of documentary with Roger and Me by putting the filmmaker on camera as kind of social justice warrior. So there was a group of us, each in our own way, expanding the definition of documentary. So Errol Morris's Thin Blue Line was a huge influence on me. It was exciting to see somebody taking the form of documentary and pushing it in a more cinematic direction. And then the third revolution to me is the advent of streaming and in particular Netflix. I mean, going after a global audience and the ascendancy of the doc series, which didn't exist when I first started. We've gone from being the bastard stepchildren of the entertainment business where you could barely get funding to like really being a mainstream part of the entertainment business where people can't get enough of documentary content and crime content in particular, you know, has never been more popular, whatever that means about us as a society.
In 2023, true crime documentaries are everywhere. You'll probably find two or three new ones just by going to your Netflix homepage. But in 1993, when Bruce and Joe were making the first Paradise Lost, true crime documentaries were still a pretty new concept.
Do you think people had not been exposed to wrongful conviction narratives for the most part until this point? I mean, what are the precursors? Thin Blue Line? Like, what even existed beforehand that was a model for you in telling a story like that?
Yeah, honestly, Thin Blue Line was a huge influence on me, but not at the start of the making of the film, because I thought we were making a film about guilty teenagers at the beginning. By the time I realized that, or we realized there was a wrongful conviction and we were deep in the editing of Paradise Lost, of course, Errol Morris's Thin Blue Line became much more of a touchstone for us than it had 3 years earlier, when it was just inspiring to see somebody expand the definition of what a documentary could be. The last thing I expected to do was to spend 20 years on this case and make three films. We thought the first movie was going to, particularly with the response it was getting, we thought it was going to just blow the prison doors, you know, wide open, much like Errol Morris's Thin Blue Line. And so it was a very strange experience to have this film be very successful. It won basically every prize you could win. It was the darling of the film festival circuit. You know, got glowing reviews. I think it's the last time I had 100 on Rotten Tomatoes. I've fallen like a rock since. You know, we're sitting there accepting Emmy Awards and Peabody Awards, and everyone's patting us on the back for this great film. And of course, from a creative standpoint, it's nice to be validated, but it felt very hollow and phony because I knew that Damien Echols was still on death row. And at this point, guards were treating him horrendously and beating him and abusing him. And every time Paradise Lost played on HBO, I don't remember if it was the governor's website or the state of Arkansas's website or the prosecutor's website. I don't remember. But one of the official websites said HBO is an entertainment company and Paradise Lost is a work of fiction. You can ignore it. Basically, that was the message. And so here we're getting patted on the back for being great filmmakers and everyone's loving the movie, but it wasn't moving the needle. And so it just felt a little hollow.
And so years passed. Bruce and Joe continued working together. Jason, Jesse, and Damien remained in prison, their lives standing still while the rest of the world moved forward.
As the films went on, they became as much about us and the filmmaking as about the case, which I have a mixed feeling about. The first film, to me, it's my favorite film I've ever made, and made it with Bruce Sinofsky, of course. But of all the films I've ever made, this film changed me as a human being. It made me aware that wrongful convictions exist. It made me aware that satanic panic hysteria exists, and it still does, that the rush to judgment and the lack of critical thinking is responsible for a lot of people being put in prison. So it kind of awakened in me like my mission in life as a filmmaker. But I also think it's an amazing example of the genre of cinema verite documentary, where you don't tell people what to think, and yet you tell a story that persuades people. Mm-hmm. And the second film was advocacy in search of a story, and is not a perfect film. In fact, Paradise Lost 2 is my least favorite of the Paradise Lost films, and is not that pure cinema verite, because Paradise Lost 2 really goes out of its way to try to tell you what to think. But I think the beauty and strength of Paradise Lost is that we didn't bang it over your head. And that produced an interesting result, because we didn't tell you specifically what to think. Probably 20% of the audience who watched Paradise Lost were buying into the prejudice.
Right.
You know, and they would say to me, God, those kids must have done it. They're so weird. Or they weren't banging their hand on the table. You know, so 20% left the theater thinking they were guilty, but the 80% who thought they were innocent were so moved by that style of filmmaking. And I think Paradise Lost went out of its way to show all sides and to show why people might think that Damien in particular, because Damien had a chip on his shoulder. The scene where he's looking in the mirror, you know, it's kind of a creepy scene, and the way he would glower at people to get a reaction out of them. You know, you had to tell that part of the story to understand how this whole community could have this panicked, evidence-less rush to judgment. But if you're in an audience being lectured to by a filmmaker and they're banging a message over your head, that is a very passive viewing experience. And either you accept the message or you don't, but it's not as involving. If you're weighing the pros and cons, gee, Damien is kind of staring at himself strangely in a mirror, but wait, there's no blood at the crime scene. I was just like that guy. I could have been Damon. It's not a passive viewing experience. It's an active viewing experience where you're weighing the pros and cons, and then you come to your own conclusion instead of being lectured to. And 80% of the people who watched the film came to that conclusion, oh my God, there's been this miscarriage of justice. And that's what I think prompted people to leave the theater and take action, which does not happen most of the time.
No.
You know,
I
made
many documentaries about many subjects and people go, nice film. And, you know, that's that. Paradise Lost 2 and Paradise Lost 3 are inferior films because they came from a place of pure advocacy in search of a story. And the only thing we could think of was, okay, for Paradise Lost 2, we're going to turn the camera on the West Memphis 3 support group, which of course involves the making of our film. And for Paradise Lost 3, we're kind of just going to tell the whole history, including the impact of the film. Those were just excuses to keep, you know, when we started Paradise Lost 3, they were still in prison. I mean, it ends on this incredible ending of them getting out of prison, but that we didn't know that then. We just felt this pressure to keep telling the story because, you know, while my career was moving on and I was having children and raising a family and having a wonderful life as a filmmaker, these guys were still in prison.
Yeah. Yeah. And Damien was getting closer and closer to being put to death. Yeah. And my favorite part of the third film is very simply the fact that you can see your relationship with Damien and Jason and Jesse having been developed. Like you have a fully developed relationship at that point, and you can see it in the way that, like, even just Damien's composure in front of the camera. He's like, when was the last time we did this? Oh yeah, 10 years ago, but like, I know you.
Paradise Lost 3 ends with the West Memphis 3 being released from prison. It's a moment of celebration, but there's a bittersweetness there too. In order to leave prison and save Damien from the death penalty, they all had to give an Alford plea, allowing the state to save face and save money at the expense of three innocent men.
And the way Joe sees it, satanic panic is not just a thing of the past. It still exists in our culture today, though in a different form.
We live now in an era of what I call the death of truth. Never have we been more connected and yet more divided, connected technologically. Never have we had information available at our fingertips, and yet the truth has never been more elusive about everything. We have half the country that can't agree with one another on whether the sky is blue, and conspiracy theories rule. And in fact, QAnon is in the U.S. Congress. QAnon is responsible for Pizzagate, and that's satanic hysteria. You encountered satanic hysteria in your case. Mm-hmm. To me, the satanic hysteria is a subset of a much larger issue, which is the truth is under assault in a very profound way that I think we haven't quite really grappled with as a society. Democracy is all about people of differing views coming together, compromising for the greater good. But if you can't agree to basic facts, if you can't agree that the sky is blue today, there is no compromise. Not to be an alarmist, but I think our core democratic values are under assault and close to crumbling. We are by no means out of the woods on the issue of truth.
Perhaps this is the greatest lesson from Wrongful Conviction and Satanic Panic stories. They show us how easily the truth can get lost amid lurid speculation and moral hysteria.
But even in our daily lives, without the spectacle of a murder trial, the truth is fragile. It needs support. And if we don't stand up for it, if we don't insist on standards of evidence, on rigorous thinking, we all suffer.
So we encourage you to continually hone your skepticism. Don't believe everything you read or hear, even from us. Do your homework and remember how easily false narratives can take hold.
In the meantime, get lost with us. Find us on Twitter, at Amanda Knox.
At Man Under Bridge.
And if you want to tell the world the truth about our podcast, please leave a 5-star review for Labyrinths.
This episode was written and produced by us and Sophia Gates, with editing and sound design by Josh Thane and theme music by Josh Budo Karp.
Captain's log, stardate 89361.5. We've encountered a fascinating alien civilization. The people of Patreon Prime are humanoid in appearance, but possess vastly greater degrees of nuance, compassion, and intelligence than any race we have so far encountered. But what is perhaps most striking is their generosity.
Captain, the warp core is going critical.
Warning.
Divert all energy to patreon.com/KnoxRobinson.